It is Tuesday, October 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump visits Pittsburgh as the city mourns the victims of a synagogue attack last Saturday. Remains are recovered from the Indonesia jetliner crash. And Cambodian genocide survivors in the U.S. get involved politically. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump are heading to Pittsburgh Tuesday to offer condolences to the families of 11 members of a Jewish synagogue who were massacred last week in an anti-Semitic rampage. But some Jewish leaders are demanding the president stay away until he denounces white nationalism. The White House announced the trip Monday, saying the president and First Lady will visit the city to express the support of the American people and to grieve with the Pittsburgh community. Pittsburgh's Democratic mayor, William Peduto, said the Republican president should stay away from the city while families are holding funerals. Several leaders of the Pittsburgh chapter of Bend the Ark, an activist Jewish organization that lobbies against Trump's policies, called on the president to cancel his visit, saying he was not welcome until he denounced white nationalism. The letter was signed by tens of thousands of people nationwide. Top congressional leaders from both political parties declined invitations from Trump to join him in visiting, while the family of one of the victims is declining to meet the president. Anti-Semitism remains a worldwide problem. In France, an Islamist militant attacked a kosher grocery store in Paris and killed four Jews in 2015. And last March, an 85-year-old woman was stabbed to death in her home in the French capital. British Jews are also concerned about their future. Jamie Detmer in London tells me memorial services took place in Britain for the victims of the Pittsburgh attack.
There were vigils right across the country, in London, in several places, in Brighton, in Oxford, in Liverpool. There will be more remembrance events as well planned for this coming weekend. The reaction is one of shock and horror. The chief rabbi here in Britain at a vigil yesterday that I was at in northwest London talked about it sending a shiver down the spine of Britain's 290,000 Jews. There had been, before this slaughter, the deadliest attack on Jews in U.S. history, the viewpoint that America was a haven, that it was sanctuary, that it was safe. And we are seeing large numbers of British Jews considering emigrating from Britain. A poll last year suggested that a third of them were considering emigration, and a poll just a month ago suggested if Labour became the next government, as many as half the 290,000 Jews would consider emigrating. Now the sense is that the haven isn't there in America anymore, and the question is for many Jews who are worried about rising anti-Semitism in the UK as well, where's safe?
Well, certainly internationally, there's been a reputation recently, in recent years, that French Jews have been very concerned. Why is this concern growing among British Jews?
Well, rather a whiplash effect, which is also being seen in Europe as well, to a certain degree, depending on the country. They see threats coming from multiple sources, from the far right, from nativists, from white supremacists, from militant Islamist actions as well. An ideology, but also from the radical left. In Britain, there has been, since 2015, a growing row within the Labour Party about accusations of anti-Semitism there. It coincides with the election in 2015, the surprise election, to the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, who's a far-left figure, who's a profound Israel critic, who is a supporter of Hamas and Hezbollah, and there's been targeting of Jewish Labour lawmakers, particularly on social media, by Corbyn supporters who've been issuing racial slurs. So all of that really has conspired to creating a high level of anxiety. We've also seen a rise in anti-Semitic incidents as well. A group that counsels synagogues and Jewish organizations on security says there were more than 700 anti-Semitic incidents in the first 6 months of this year.
Well, apparently there's also been a move by some British Jews to consider relocating to Germany, of all places. I mean, that's kind of interesting.
Well, I mean, that's fascinating. Under a German law, Jews who lost their citizenship in the Nazi era, or their parents were killed and they'd emigrated, can reapply for a German passport. And there has been a dramatic rise from about 43 in 2015 doing this to 1,667 doing it last year. It's not so much the idea, I am told, to resettle in Germany. It's more in the light of Brexit. They feel it's a good idea, these people who are applying, so they get a second European Union passport, which then would allow them, of course, to have freedom of movement within the European Union, where they could select the country that they feel safe in to settle.
It's a bit like those Britons that are taking out Irish citizenship for that reason.
In a sense, yes, but I suppose it's more eye-opening that these are the descendants of Jews who fled Nazi Germany or were killed in Nazi Germany or in nearby countries. And I think that's what startled people and attracted their eye. But yes, in a sense, it is partly a result of Brexit that they're doing that. And you are seeing some Jews of Portuguese extract doing the same thing, applying for passports in Portugal.
But have there been, the violent incidents that have taken place, unfortunately, recently in France? Are those kinds of things happening in the UK?
No. I ought to stress there's been no lethal violence in recent years towards British Jews. But the threats are there, the underlying ideologies are there, and we are seeing, about 50 or so per year, anti-Semitic incidents involving violence, but not lethal violence. There's been no attack by Islamist militants on synagogues here, and there has been no dramatic attack by the far right on synagogues or Jewish organizations here. But we did have, at the beginning of this week, it emerged that now the British government has decided that the intelligence services should become the lead monitoring organization of far-right groups as opposed to the police, because they think the threat could well grow from the ranks of the far-right.
Jamie Detmer reporting from London. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Ex-Guantanamo Taliban prisoners joined the team negotiating peace with the United States. Thousands protest in Sri Lanka over the ouster of the prime minister. Bangladesh and Myanmar agree to repatriate Rohingyas. And President Trump aims to end birthright citizenship. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study from a professor and evolutionary biologist at the University of California, Riverside, suggests since tall people have more cells than normal-sized people, they are at an increased risk of cancer. To reach his findings, Professor Leonard Nunney examined and analyzed the data from four major studies, which covered 23 cancer categories. Nunney says he found that in each of the studies he evaluated, he found that they established that tall people have an increased risk of cancer. He adds that the risk increases by 10% for every 10 centimeters in additional height. In a press release quote, Nunney says that height increases cell numbers and that having more cells directly increases cancer risk. The professor's study was published in the journal The Proceedings of the Royal Society B. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the Vatican speaks concerning the Spanish decision to exhume the body of the late dictator Francisco Franco. Indonesian divers resumed the search Tuesday for the cockpit recorders so investigators can determine why Lion Air Flight JT610 crashed in the Java Sea Monday as the pilot tried to return to Jakarta Airport shortly after takeoff. All 189 people on board are presumed dead. Only debris and body parts have been found and removed for identification. Contact with the Boeing 737 MAX 8 was lost 13 minutes after it lifted off on its way to Pangkai, Penang. The crash site is about 15 kilometers from shore and water up to 35 meters deep. Investigators are trying to figure out why the pilot radioed for permission to return to the airport. There was no distress signal. The chief of Lion Air Group said the plane suffered a technical problem on a previous flight from Bali to Jakarta Sunday, but it had been resolved according to procedure. John Cox, CEO of the Washington-based Safety Operating Systems Aviation Consultancy, spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty about the crash and the Boeing 737, a widely used aircraft that has been constantly upgraded and improved since the 1960s.
So this is a proven airframe. It's a proven workhorse, and this is the most modern, up-to-date electronics, computers, and engines, the most fuel-efficient model of the 737. So it has quite a lengthy history that investigators will, of course, look at. The area around Indonesia in general can be very challenging in that there are mountains and some of the islands are pretty remote. It has beautiful resorts such as Bali. It has not got the most extensive infrastructure system, so it can be a challenging area for pilots. But fortunately, the newer generation airplanes, such as the 737 MAX 8, have got onboard flight computers that make the job of navigating a good bit simpler.
Well, John, the weather apparently was not a factor. It was clear at takeoff. Data from Flight Radar 24 showed the first sign of something amiss about 2 minutes into the flight when the plane reached about 2,000 feet or 600 meters. It descended more than 150 meters, veered to the left before climbing again, where it stayed during most of the rest of the flight. Does that give you any clues?
The first thing is, as an accident investigator, you have to really validate the data. So the initial raw data says that the airplane descended. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. We need to validate those data points. But there is indication that it climbed to 5,000 feet, and that would be normal if the crew were having some type of abnormality. That's a good altitude. You're well away from the ground, and it gives you an opportunity to go through the checklist, to do the problem solving necessary. They determined that they wanted to return back to Jakarta. They didn't declare an emergency, which all of this says that they were handling the situation. They didn't feel that they were in imminent danger, and they did exactly what they're trained to do. They methodically went through the checklist. What went wrong after that, and the investigators will look very carefully at, but those answers we don't have yet.
The aircraft, after the ascent and the turnaround, began actually gaining speed in the final moments, reaching 345 knots before data was lost when it was at about 1,100 meters. Does that give you any further clues, or we're just going to have to wait for the black boxes to be recovered?
First, the recorders will tell us the entire story. But the limited data that we have, one of the things that struck me was, why is the speed so high? And if, in fact, that turns out to be true, then that will help the investigators understand that whatever was wrong in those last, say, 20 seconds of the flight, something appears to be terribly wrong here. And the investigators are going to look for what could possibly have caused such a very rapid descent rate at such a high speed.
John Cox of Safety Operating Systems. The Vatican will not oppose the exhumation of the remains of the late Spanish dictator Francisco Franco and the removal from a huge mausoleum outside Madrid built in memory of the fallen in the 1930s Spanish Civil War. But still unclear is where Franco's remains will then be buried. Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
During and after a bitterly fought civil war in which Generalissimo Francisco Franco's nationalist forces defeated leftist Republicans, the Spanish leader engaged in an organized effort to stamp out remaining leftist and communist movements in Spain, a campaign in which tens of thousands of people were either executed, sent to concentration camps, or exiled. Franco's government had close ties with the Roman Catholic Church. Since assuming power this year, the Spanish socialist government of Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has given the push to exhume the remains of the late military dictator, which have been buried in the Valley of the Fallen near Madrid since his death in 1975. It has now obtained the assurances from the Vatican that the Catholic Church's leadership will not oppose the move, which has been highly controversial in Spain. Spain's Deputy Prime Minister, Carmen Calvo, held a two-hour meeting with Secretary of State Pietro Parolin at the Vatican this week, described by the Spanish government as extremely cordial. A government statement issued after the meeting said the church shared its concern, which is the same as the government's, to grant justice to the victims of abuses and prevent these events in the future. Calvo recently defended the Spanish government's decision to exhume Franco's remains from its current resting place, deemed by many to be inappropriate and disrespectful.
No hay respeto, no hay honra, no hay justicia, no hay paz.
But the Deputy Prime Minister said, there is no respect, no honor, no justice, no peace or harmony while the remains of Franco are in the same place as those of the victims. Where Franco's remains would be reinterred is unclear. Calvo has explained that although the government can have the exhumation take place, it is up to the dictator's family to decide where his remains will be moved. Franco's family owns a crypt in the Almudena Cathedral in Madrid city center, but there too have been protests outside the church against the possibility of having the dictator's remains placed there. On the reburial, the Vatican and Spanish government agreed on the need to find a solution and continue to maintain dialogue. The mausoleum in the Valley of the Fallen holds the remains of some 34,000 people who fought on both sides in the Spanish Civil War. The Spanish government presented it as a place of reconciliation at the time, but in the years after the death of the dictator, it turned into a symbolic site for those nostalgic of the Franco days, and from the viewpoint of the current government and those on the left, is portrayed as an embarrassment for Spain's modern democracy. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
A scientific study 3 years in the making has come up with 25 simple cost-effective measures that it says can reduce air pollution in the Asia-Pacific region and save the lives of millions of people who die prematurely each year from its effects. As Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva, the study coincides with the agency's first ever global conference on air pollution.
The World Health Organization reports more than 90% or nearly 2 billion children under the age of 15 breathe toxic air every day. The WHO says debilitating problems associated with air pollution begin at conception and continue until adolescence. The report notes pregnant women exposed to polluted air are likely to give birth prematurely and have low-weight babies. A WHO scientist and expert on air pollution, Marie-Noëlle Brun-Dries, warns that many babies will have neurodevelopment problems resulting in lower IQs.
The fact that air pollution is stunting our brains even before we are born, the fact that it's leading to diseases that we may not be able to see immediately but look at much later in life, like adult diseases, our lung function and our respiratory systems are being altered during their development.
Dries says this can lead to chronic respiratory and cardiovascular diseases, as well as certain types of cancers later in life. In 2016, the report estimated that 600,000 children died from acute lower respiratory infections caused by polluted air. It said the heaviest toll is paid by children in low and middle-income countries. The report found that the highest death rates among children between the ages of 5 and 14 from both ambient and household air pollution occur in the African region. The report says switching to clean cooking and heating fuels and technologies could save the lives of many children. It says other measures for reducing the toxic impact of air pollution include moving away from fossil fuels. The report recommends the use of cleaner, renewable energy sources, less dependence on private cars in favor of public transportation, and better waste management systems. WHO officials say the benefits from implementing such measures will be felt almost immediately. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. During every election season, as many American citizens prepare to go to the polls, one group of immigrants has traditionally chosen not to get involved. The Cambodian community in the U.S. has been fearful of the government because of its past, but this midterm election is different. The largest Cambodian community in the U.S. is taking political action. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has their story from Long Beach, California.
This is a place of refuge for genocide survivors who are seeking peace.
I experienced extreme violence. I saw extreme violence where my mother was being to near death.
Demand your rights.
Laura Som founded the May Center to help survivors of the Cambodian genocide heal from the trauma of the Khmer Rouge's reign of terror. The communist regime killed roughly 2 million people. Here, students can take a civics class, a topic dear to Som, who says her father was murdered in Cambodia because he was against the government.
I spend my entire life, from then until now, to learn and heal myself so I could be civically involved, because I know that's the only way.
Som was teaching civics when her student V. Sarong asked the question that started a movement.
I asked the question of why Cambodian community doesn't have such political voice.
Members of the Cambodian community traditionally have not participated in local government or voted. The reason, says Charles Song, is fear.
Most of us didn't have a say back in our country because we live under so oppressive government that any say would probably end up with missing, you know, your brother and sister and all of that.
Cambodian Americans make up about 4% of the total population in Long Beach. More than half of them live in and near an area called Cambodiatown. This area is divided into four districts with four representatives. The Cambodian community has gathered thousands of signatures asking city officials to redraw district lines so Cambodiatown is consolidated into one district with one representative who understands its special needs.
We're people of the earth. We want plants and gardens. This is how we heal ourselves. But yet we are put into a community where it's a cement jungle.
Civil rights attorney Mark Coleman says other ethnic minority groups have succeeded at redistricting.
The Latino community did the same thing, and they created what more or less has been called a Latino district.
The Cambodian community is also supporting an item on the November ballot calling for an independent citizens group to redistrict the city after the 2020 census instead of having city officials draw the lines. Redistricting of the city will not be considered, said city officials, until after the 2020 census to get the most accurate population count. Song says he will keep fighting. He has survived much worse.
And that survival mode can only be used as a tool.
For many genocide survivors, this fight for representation is one step towards finding peace.
That report by Elizabeth Lee. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.